You are listening to Food Action in the Shoe Swap. I call it Food Action for short. This show is inspired by the Shoe Swap Food Action Co-op, a local organization of diverse individuals and groups dedicated to creating a model community where everyone has access to locally grown, healthy, affordable food. I am your host, Jerry Paquette, co-author of the book Eat to Save Your Life, and Director of Education with the Shoe Swap Food Action Co-op. Join me every week as I bring in guests from various aspects of the food industry to explore the relationship between the food decisions you make and your ability to take charge yourself of health issues like diabetes type 2, inflammation, excess weight, cardiovascular problems, and more. It's all about the relationship between food and your health. And as always, I invite you to call in with your questions or comments or stories to 250-463-5026. That's 463-5026. Today, I have Mr. Herman Drescher, who, with his wife Inger, recently organized a walk against Monsanto in Enderby. I enjoyed their walk and explored their objections, concerns, and ideas about GM foods in general and the Monsanto Corporation in particular. Herman is with me in the studio today to continue that discussion. Right now, you're listening to Food Action with me, Jerry Paquette, on CKVS 93.7 FM. My studio guest is Herman Drescher. Hello, Herman.
Hello, good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me, Jerry.
Oh, you're welcome. I talked to your wife, and she said, Jerry, you're a talk show. You got to get Herman on that. Herman is a political activist and an organizer with his wife, Inger, of Enderby's recent march against Monsanto. He's going to talk about that. Welcome, Herman. You live with your wife, Inger, in Enderby, and together you provide a variety of services to your community. I looked up you guys on LinkedIn and found out you facilitate meetings, workshops, social gatherings, but you do more than that, and primarily you're a farmer.
Yes, that's right, Jerry.
So why don't you talk a little bit about, we'll get to your farm, right? We'll have a couple of leaping off points. You're from Germany.
Yes.
Inger is from?
Norway.
Norway.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how you got to Canada and how you ended up particularly in Enderby, that wonderful bread basket.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry, for inviting me, first of all. And we came over in 1956 from Germany on a ship called the Seven Seas, and we pulled into the St. Lawrence and into Quebec, and we boarded a train, and we came right across Canada. I was 5.5 years old, and right to Vancouver, where my grandparents were, along with a few uncles and aunts, and I've stayed there all my life until January 1, 1975. I moved to Kamloops as a business transfer for the company I worked for, and I was there until basically 1991, and when we parted our ways and moved to Kelowna, moved to Vernon. I had a business there and supplied many of the businesses that might be listening, including DeMille's, our sponsor here today.
And what was the business you were doing?
Well, it was I worked for a company called Hobart Manufacturing. We sold butcher equipment, manufactured butcher equipment. We manufactured Hobart scales and slicers and meat grinders and dishwashers and dough mixers. So I used to call on all the bakeries and the restaurants and the bars and wherever there's food and so on, where the machinery is required.
How did you learn to do all that?
Well, I graduated in 1969, had the weekend off, and I was
graduated from
Gladstone High,
okay,
in Vancouver. And the gentleman, our counselors at the time, they said, you know, if people want, companies were looking for employees, they would go to our school and say, hey, is there any potential? So the fellow that was a service manager for Hobart at the time, they needed someone in dispatch. And so they he happened to be a graduate from Gladstone Senior Secondary. So, and this is the school I was in. So, a fellow by the name of Bob Blair was a wonderful, wonderful fellow. Mm. And anyway, so I was with them and moved up the ranks into from there into parts, into accounting, and then on the road to sales. And then they didn't have, we didn't have a real presence in the interior other than, you know, every 3 months there would be a road trip coming through. So they decided to open a branch in Vern, in Kamloops, and asked me if I would transfer up there to do that.
Hmm. So that was your introduction, tangentially anyway, to food.
Yeah. Well, at Kamloops, we got out of the city of Vancouver. We're able to buy a small hobby farm. And the thing that it kind of leads me over to, we bought a house, and later on we bought a new house when our first, actually we moved into apartment first, and then we bought our first brand new house, very, a very modest little common carport deal out north of Kamloops. And I'll have to tell you, when it started, my interest in the whole food and chemical concerns, we put up a fence around this brand newly developed clay and sand muskeg of a surrounding. It was a brand new subdivision. And I planted lawn in the main part of the backyard, and I had 2 feet away from the fence. We built a solid 6-foot cedar fence, and 2 feet away from it, I decided to plant some beans all along the way. So my neighbor, he says, "Oh, you know, you've got a bunch of weeds here in the lawn. You better do something about it." And I said, "Well, what do you recommend?" And he says, "Oh, this stuff is 2,4-D. It should work really well."
It should.
So anyway, I had it in a spreader. I'm walking along with the spreader just on the edge of the lawn, and the beans were within 6 inches of it. As I'm walking, I notice the leaves were drooping as I was walking, and I stopped, and then I pulled again.
Was this a liquid?
So, no, powder.
It was powder.
Okay. It was powder, and I thought, wow, this is incredible. What's going on here? You know, like it's, and then I started, that was my aha moment, where I thought, this is dangerous stuff. If it's doing this to the plant, what's it doing to the microbes in the soil and the earthworms, and what would happen if the birds pecked, you know, ate the worms that after I did that, had
which
done
they
that.
Would do, right?
Yeah. And then I was concerned, what about my daughter, my kids, and my newly born daughter when she crawls around? And so it all started right there. That was in 1976. And anyway, and I was very, you know, cognizant of the fact that there is bad stuff out there, and I avoided it with the plague. But I noticed also in foods, it started creeping up, the processed foods. There's so many things that aren't labeled. And then you look into pesticides and herbicides and fungicides, and I discovered only the first ingredient has to be basically researched and declared. In other words, if it had 20 ingredients, it's only the first one, which is the largest percentage of
all
of them.
Yeah, and that can be the most innocent. It could be water.
That's right, yeah. So anyway, it was that's really worrisome, because why would a company, like, for example, glyphosate is my biggest concern out there, and it should be everyone's biggest concern, because it is so... It has been used very indiscriminately all over the place. We even have a law in British Columbia for cosmetic pesticide controls where you're not supposed to use it in city lawns. And you see goofy ads that circumvent the, you know, saying what it should be used for or what it shouldn't be used for. And there was recently an article that said can be used on hard surfaces.
Yeah, you were telling me about that earlier. That was great. And that's right here in Salmon Arb.
And glyphosate, of course, is a main ingredient in Roundup. GMOs are of a concern, of course.
Can I read a paragraph
sure.
from the University, well, MIT?
Sure.
They have a program there. It's a website that some of the students have made up, and the professors, they monitor it. And they've got some definitions on there that I thought might help our listeners follow what you're going to say, because it's a very complicated thing you're about to take us into.
Mm-hmm.
Even for those who already know something about it, it's complicated. So let me read from this website. And I apologize, I don't have the website information here for me. I'll have to get that for people if you want it. Here's what they say about Roundup. Roundup ready crops are crops genetically modified to be resistant to the herbicide Roundup. They're very focused on that, right?
Right, right.
Roundup is the brand name of a herbicide produced by Monsanto. Its active ingredient, glyphosate, was patented in the 1970s. Roundup is now widely used by both people in their backyards, as you're saying, and farmers in their fields. Roundup ready plants are resistant to Roundup, so farmers that plant these seeds must use Roundup to keep other weeds from growing in their fields. The first Roundup ready crops were developed in 1996 with the introduction of genetically modified soybeans that are resistant to Roundup. These crops were developed to help farmers control weeds. Because the new crops are resistant to Roundup, the herbicide can be used in the fields to eliminate unwanted foliage. Current Roundup-ready crops include soy, corn, canola, alfalfa, cotton, and sorghum, with wheat under development. Roundup-ready crop seeds have notoriously been referred to as terminator seeds. I hadn't heard that word before. This is because the crops produced from Roundup Ready seeds are sterile. Each year, farmers must purchase the most recent strain of seed from Monsanto. That's right. And this means that farmers cannot reuse their best seed. I thought that was a nice, cogent take on what it's all about.
Yeah,
for people.
There's one thing that I feel isn't exactly accurate. There are terminator seeds, but Roundup, if you recall, Percy Schmeiser in Saskatchewan, he was accused of keeping some seeds over, and that's why you signed the contract. They're not of a terminator seed. Most of them are not. They have that technology. They're not utilizing it yet. Mm. So that's the only thing I would say that's not quite right there, Jerry.
Well, we'll keep up to speed on this because I find that as I get into the website, because that's my main source of information for all of this, which is true for most everybody, things change weekly. And I find I just don't know who to believe when I read these things.
Yeah.
I like MIT,
right.
So I tend to follow them a bit where I can. But I don't know for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not that far off. That's not of a terminator seeds. It's just that you can't replant it again. But they have a contract. If that was the case, if canola and soy and corn were all terminator seeds, they wouldn't have to have a contract because nobody would think of keeping seeds over because it wouldn't work.
That's right. Well, this is what happened in India, where Monsanto just took over and we lost something like 300,000 farmers to suicide.
Yes.
They lost their seeds through this process.
Yeah.
But let's move on from there.
Mm-hmm.
You started in your back garden. You became aware of toxics. You had, and this was 1970s, and you had the wherewithal at that point in time not to think just about your wilting beans, but your microbes under the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And microbes are essential. They're fundamental. You start killing those off, then we don't have anything. We're on our way to killing ourselves. And you were thinking about that back in 1970.
Yes, I was concerned about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all of our wealth on this planet comes from the earth, and we treat it like dirt. It's soil, and we should respect it, and we should look after it and utilize it, pass it on to our children and grandchildren, and as we've been on the planet Earth over 10,000 years. man has been here. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible that we, in such a short period of time, like in the last 30 years or so, we're going all out to destroy it.
Yeah, we've transformed it. I mean, it goes back more than 30 years. we can go back to the years of the Dust Bowl in the 30s and have a look at it. Probably a singular moment there. We could fudge that, but a singular moment with the dust blowing in the air being our soil.
Right.
That was horrendous, and we never recovered from that.
Right.
In my opinion.
Yeah. No, you're right, and I think you know, that's so important. That point is soil. We've never recovered from it, and we are depleting whatever minerals we have in soil at such a phenomenal rate that, you know, the human species, if we don't starve to death, we'll annihilate ourselves from poisoning ourselves or whatever. So it's really, we need to smarten up out there. You know, everybody needs to do their part.
Now, you're farming now, and you own a small farm called Ashton Oasis Farm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it says here you have registered Guernsey milk cows, eggs, pesticide-free vegetables in season. So you're farming. This sounds like a little more than a hobby farm now. And you're farming, and you're doing it the way you think it should be done.
Right, right.
Let's talk about that before we move to Monsanto.
Okay.
How do you farm?
Well, we bought a wonderful little place with a couple of creeks going through it. And living in Kamloops, we lived in a place that the well went dry, and we lived up in a place called Knutsford, high up on the way to Merritt, before the Coca-Cola opened. And I hauled water every day for chickens, goats, cows, and kids for bathing and flushing toilets every day of the year. And back then, winters were very cold. So I went to a gas station every day to haul. I had a tank made specifically to fit my station wagon, and I hauled water every day. Eventually, I talked the city into giving me a wrench so I could open the fire hydrant up so I could fill it up in under 10 seconds. And it's a wonderful thing, those fire hydrants, I'll tell you.
Farmers have to be inventive fellas,
so,
and ladies don't.
Anyway, it was quite an experience. We have basically bought a home on river bottom. So the first thing we did is there was a gentleman, a friend of ours, that whose brother had just sold his dairy quota, and he had to get rid of all this cow manure and bedding. And I says, I'll take it all. And we made a deal, and we brought in 48 dump trucks. And by the time I spread that around with my little 30 horsepower tractor, it was a skiff, like half inch over the whole acreage, barely, you know, over the flat part, usable part. So I thought, wow, I've got a long ways to go here. So you can either keep buying compost, you know, like manure and wood chips and so on, or you can bring on some animals and buy hay and put it through the animals and make your own manure. So I chose to do a mix of both. When the chipping truck comes down the highway, I go there and I say, hey, when you guys are finished chipping and it's full, come on in, dump it down at my place. I would love to have it. Thank you. And they've done that, and it's great. And
these chips are small enough. I mean, I don't know anything about this.
They literally take branches like that are touching the telephone or the hydro line, and they put it through. And some of the chips are a little bit more substantial. But basically, you can shovel them and put them around your trees and your garden as a mulch and what have you. I also use it as bedding for my chickens and my ducks and for my cows. So it's wonderful stuff. So it gets used and recycled. It gives you a real feeling that you're helping to save the planet. Matter of fact, one of the fellows on the truck out in Ashton Creek, I said, where would you haul this? And he said, we would have to haul it all the way to Coldstream, to dump it. So can you imagine a 5-ton truck or so driving all the way from Enderby out to Coldstream and then back again to continue? So I was so, you know, how much of an oil slick did I save by just getting him to drop it at my place? You know, I'm doing everybody, the whole planet, a favor here.
Okay, nice. So continue with your own farming and your strategies. And I'm looking at how you stay away from Monsanto.
Well, what we do is we've made our own soil by composting. Mm-hmm. And we've built raised beds out of 2x12 cedar rough, and we lined the bottom with tin, and we put compost and soil on top, and we try to grow as much as we can. We also make a point of supporting whatever we don't grow. We go to the farmer's market. I go to the farmer's market to sell my chicken eggs, duck eggs, and a little bit of produce that I have available. And we buy from the farmer's market what we don't grow. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we try to keep the dollar, we try to stimulate the local economy. And this is, you know, this is really important, because one day the situation is going to, a landslide, an earthquake, who knows what could happen. We're going to be cut off from, you know, the trucks pulling it out of California and what have you. So we're going to start eating.
We only have a few days of food sitting on the shelves of stores.
Exactly.
You know, John McLeod likes to point out that a lot and say, if we don't start looking after the local farmers and learn the value of that,
right,
we're going to come face to face with that crisis for ourselves.
You're so exactly.
You're reiterating, John.
Yep. Yeah. I bought a 1924. This little short story. I bought a 1924 incubator from a lady up in Likely, BC, and I got to talking to her, and it just my daughter came down from Prince George, and perfect timing. She picked it up for me, and she told me about what is she involved with. And Williams Lake was the first city in Canada that got awarded an award for a sustainability and local, I don't recall the exact name
language,
of the award,
yeah,
but
yeah.
What they did is there was a bulk plant, an oil bulk plant up there that has been sitting vacant for 10, 15 years or so, and a group of people up there said, hey, how about we form a food co-op? And they went around and they asked, you know, they went to Overwady and they went to Walmart and they went everywhere. And at first, some of these bigger outfits, they kind of had their backs up a little bit, thinking, ooh, this is competition, we don't want more. But then when they said to the managers, do you know if we are cut off from the mainland, how many hours worth of food we have here in Williams Lake? How many hours? And they have 72 hours.
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 Wow.
So that would apply to any community. You know, Salmon Arm, for the number of stores you have here, your population is somewhat proportionate. Enderby, for the population we have, it's somewhat proportionate. Vancouver, Coquitlam, or Surrey, can you imagine? 72 hours and the shelves will be bare, including you, Mr. Store Manager.
Mm-hmm.
So they all took it to heart. They thought about it and they realized, hey, yeah, it is a problem. So what they did is they had the city of Williams Lake contact the oil company and said, there's a group that is willing to pay. They would like to rent your building, which has been vacant for 10 plus years. They want to rent it, and they will pay your property taxes for you. Mm. So they agreed, and then they got together, and people, farmers in the area that had were growing vegetables or raised chicken or beef or pork or whatever, they all got involved in this. So it gave them purpose. Why would I keep raising chickens or pork if I don't have a market or it's too much hassle? So this was a perfect outlet. So they are prepared. And Williams Lake was the first city in Canada to do this. And I think bravo to those people.
Yeah.
So anyway, and I think that's a good example of what we should all be shooting for. Mm-hmm. And so it gives purpose for a farmer to continue farming what they are. So we, you know, if there's not the demand for the food, you know, like I'm not going to grow 200 feet of garlic if everybody else is growing garlic or if there's no demand for it. Mm-hmm. So I shrunk down my garlic patch quite considerably because of that. So. Anyway,
we have our farmers, our local farmers, you must talk. You must make decisions about what you're going to do on the basis of what others are doing, et cetera. Is that the case? Is there a collaboration of small farmers? Does that happen?
There are some get-togethers, but I think pretty much everyone knows their market. It's you know, farmers are real free enterprisers also. But they're respectful of the land, and that's something we should, you know, cows are holy in India. I know why cows are holy in India. And we should respect them more than we are doing these days. But I'm glad there's a movement to, you know, to bring about more better living conditions and treatment of animals that we eat.
And in part, this movement has to do with organics and certification, which is another set of problems. But that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
All of that.
You mimic nature, and nature looks after herself.
Yeah. And the funny thing about organic is it's what we don't add.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You know.
And that'll get us into Monsanto, won't it?
Yeah, well, you see, you don't have to add all that stuff. As a matter of fact, insects, when you have insect pest problems, you know what? The only thing I spray at my place is water.
Water?
And, yeah. Now, you know what? Insects, seriously, when I'm any plant that is sick, it doesn't matter what plant or animal that's sick, what'll happen is that the insects will be there to clean it up. They're nature's scavengers. When you see the old Western shows, you see a guy who's out in a desert and he's been shot or whatever, the buzzards aren't circling the healthy guy down a mile down the road. They're over this guy or this animal that is going to expire any minute. And they're there to clean it up. That's Mother Nature's way of taking care of things.
What an interesting concept. And one, I'm not a farmer, and I don't have that concept.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. There must be cases where insects attack healthy plants as well. But you're saying, in the main, if I got a plant that's under attack by a lot of insects, and it's unusual, the plant is already sick, and that's why they're there?
That's correct.
Wow.
The plant is sick, and you know, I have a wonderful video. It's called The Other Side of the Fence, and it's a Dr. Albright video. He's passed away, but he had four doctorates and in soils, and he also had to do with medical. He's sort of the father of calcium, and what he is saying, this whole discussion of what I'm talking about here, Jerry, is basically mineral deficiencies. That's why I'm here today, because that's the biggest single concern that I've got with this whole business.
Well, let's talk about that in a minute. Let me remind everybody why we're here and who we are. You are now listening to Food Action with me, Jerry Paquette, and my guest, Herman Drescher, on CKVS 93.7 FM. There's no conversation like we're having here today with Herman and myself without sponsors. So let me remind you that DeMille's Farm Market sponsors Food Action. DeMille's offers a wide selection of fresh, quality fruit and produce from their own farm, from other local farms, and from farms around the world. DeMille's is open 7 days a week, from sunrise to sunset, and has been open since 1970, about when you started, Herman. For more information, visit DeMille's website at demillesfarmmarket.com or by calling directly at 250-832-7550. Well, Herman, you raised some really interesting things that are going to give me some opportunities to go home and do more research on these, because that's a powerful notion,
mm-hmm.
and I hadn't thought about it mm-hmm. before. The insects are buzzards.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Let's then follow your lead. You said this is about This is about minerals in the soil. Now, I know when I see somebody buy a bag of fertilizer, he or she or they are adding some minerals to the soil. Doesn't that do it?
A lot of times, those are not minerals. They are, first of all, they are chemical, and your plants, they will accept them. Just visualize how organic. Let's compare organically grown food to conventional fertilizer.
We may need two shows here, Herman, to get to Monsanto.
Well, we may.
And I'm not unhappy with that.
No.
So let's pursue this. Let's help people understand soil. That's what you're doing
sure.
here now.
Okay. Sure. Now, if you were like in the case of, let's say, dry land alfalfa, mm-hmm. the alfalfa that's grown in fields where there's no irrigation whatsoever, and comparing that across this highway, there is irrigated alfalfa, which looks green, it's more lush and what have you. Now, if I was to say to you, which of those alfalfas do you think is the healthiest?
Well, I'd go with green.
You would, yeah, most people would go for the greenest that you can. And it's green because it's water and very little, like a lot less nutrients in it than the dry land. The dry land alfalfa roots, they can travel up to 30 feet underground looking for minerals.
Little tiny alfalfa shoots can go 30 feet down?
When they're mature, they will. They can go 30 feet down looking for minerals.
So and are you saying the irrigated side, they're not growing that root system. They're getting
correct.
Nutrients from the water, but not from the soil, which has the nutrients they really need.
Yeah. When you are, for example, when I have grow a beet, my beets sometimes have a taproot that's a foot and a half long. Like most people don't see beets with taproots on them a foot and a half long.
No, beets are often very, very round, almost no root on them, washed and clean, and that's how they grow, right?
Yeah. So visualize
I don't
this.
Think so, yeah.
I'm going to just play the devil's advocate here about a beet growing in your garden. Just think about it. You plant a beet seed, and organic farmer, he waters and he puts compost in and what have you, and he waters it, and that beet root is looking for minerals and nutrients. So that beet root will go as far searching for it as it needs to go. Now look at farmer that uses chemical fertilizer. That like the irrigated alfalfa, if the water comes on, the ground is always wet pretty much the whole season until a few days before a hay harvest. So the beet, when you use chemical fertilizer and you toss it over for a beet, the beet root has got all the nutrients that right at surface. And so it doesn't have to look. It's got all of it. So good, bad, or indifferent. And plants don't know. I know one of the fertilizer fellows I spoke to, the representatives, and he says, the plants don't know the difference. But you know what? When you have good compost, you grow world record pumpkins and squash and you name it, where if you use chemical fertilizer, that's very unlikely. And we're not even talking the health aspects of it, because your chemical fertilizers basically is nitrogen. And like people buy 20-20-20, let's say. Okay.
Explain what that means.
On a bag, it'll be 20-20-20 or 4-30-15. The first number is always nitrogen. The second is phosphorus, how much phosphorus is in it. And potassium is your third number. Now, 20-20-20 is a big contributor to the runoff fertilizers. Nitrogen blooms in lakes and so on, because putting a spray of 20-20-20 on your field, for example, and they put it once at the beginning, and that's it for the whole season. That's sort of like saying to you, Jerry, okay, this is, I want you to pig out on this is your only meal for the whole season, okay? Now, you are going, so you eat, and you're not going to get any food until September or fall. So for the whole crop growing season, you're throwing that fertilizer on one shot.
And it can't take it all in.
It can't take it all in. That's okay. Right. So much of it. A plant can probably only use, now, you know, there, it varies on soil and how much you water and what have you. But, you know, 5-5-5 is pretty much it.
Hmm.
So anything over and above it, but big numbers impress people for some reason.
But now there's only three numbers on that bag. There's a lot more, many more minerals than just three. So what are we doing just fertilizing with three if we're fertilizing at all?
Well, we're fertilizing, but the thing is you're eventually fertilizing, you're destroying certain microbes. You may be helping other microbes out, you know, the less desirable.
The natural balance of
that's
microbial.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you do that, and of course, it becomes like your soil is like almost as if you were dumping salt on it. And we tend to do this when something grows. Years ago, corn was grown for protein, and when it isn't anymore, farmers change to another crop. And it's pretty much, you know, a hopeless situation to try to grow them for years. And, you know, years later, you might attempt it again. But usually we destroy the soil with growing a monocrop. That means one type of thing, only corn, only soy, only anything. Even only beets is not good news. You need to do crop rotation. And because, a good rule is 1 year grow things on let's say, a plot. That's plot number one. You grow things that grow underground, like carrots or beets or whatever. Next, the following year, on that plot, grow something above ground, like spinach or a chard or tomatoes or, you know. So switch back and forth, for underground, above ground. That's always a good
rule. You're replenishing minerals, you're preventing some of the minerals from being exhausted, but probably more, or at least as importantly, you are helping maintain the balance of microbial life.
Right.
All right, so you get that balance, and that's the work of the farmer,
mm-hmm.
an organic farmer. That's mm-hmm. what you're setting out to do. So where does Monsanto come in? Why have they appealed to so many farmers around the world?
Well, the appeal is that it helps for weed control. But the problem is, in other words, when you put corn in or soy, anything genetically modified, when you spray Roundup, what it does, it basically kills everything on that piece of land.
Except the plants that have been engineered.
That's right.
It.
Now okay. you would the DNA, the Roundup gene, has been Roundup ready. That's how what the referral is to
and
it.
That's not a natural gene, is
no.
it? No. That's a splicing very synthetic.
What they do is, in one way they do it, is they use a gene gun where they actually have specks of gold and they put the DNA, the Roundup gene, and fire it right into the seeds.
Mm.
That's one of the ways. It will never happen in nature. It never will happen that way. And I know there's people out there that in the rumor mills that like to murky the water. And I'm glad we're finally on the subject. One of the things, Jerry, that there was a molecule that was invented in the 50s, in 1950. And what we're talking about here is glyphosate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, this molecule was invented in the 50s. It was patented in 1964 by the Stouffer Chemical Company in the United States. The Stouffer Chemical Company was in business to sell products that could be clean minerals off industrial pipes and boilers. When you have a tea kettle at home, and if you boil, or a pot that you use continually to put water in and boil, you will have scale, lime buildup, or rusty iron buildup, or something like that.
But a mineral buildup.
That's correct. So glyphosate was invented for the purpose of descaling boilers and water tanks and so on. So what it did is it removed and locked up those minerals right in the glyphosate. Mm. Now, this is the important thing. When you talk, you could talk to 100 people and if 50 agree with my stance and 50 disagree with it, I would say that there's no denying. This is factual. This happened, and the glyphosate continues in and around the 70s. I was just trying to think of the exact date, but anyway, Monsanto comes along and buys the patent for glyphosate, and they realize that. That they can make more money selling this as a chemical to further the Roundup gene, and the scientists went to work, the biotechnicians, and it is the main ingredient in Roundup. And the glyphosate, when you spray it on the soil, the reason everything dies is not from some sort of a miraculous acid burn or something like that. It starves it of all minerals. Now, the problem with starving it of all minerals, just like in a boiler or in your tea kettle, that it absorbs and holds on to the minerals. Well, it ties it to the soil, and it remains there for a period of years, possibly.
The Roundup does, or the
glyphosate does. Okay, you got to remember, Roundup, they only it's proprietary information. Sure. They don't have to declare anything other than the main ingredient, and that's why we know so much about glyphosate. We know nothing about any of their others, and it's the way that it's the lawmakers of the in the U.S. and of course we tend to rubber stamp everything in Canada when it comes to these matters. They write the law and say only the first ingredient has to be declared, and so on.
So we don't know.
We don't know. Obviously, 49% of Roundup, the component, is 49% is glyphosate.
Okay, so we have Monsanto. They have acquired the patent for the glyphosate.
Yes.
Molecule, I suppose, or chemical formula.
Yes.
Whatever, and its application.
Yes.
It goes in there and it acquires the mineral content of the soil that the weeds are interested in, that they need to grow, so they die.
Yes.
And we're left with, here's what I'm not clear. What are we left with? The
glyphosate.
Glyphosate.
Yes.
Acquires it, holds on to it.
Yes.
Is it not usable by another plant? That bunch of minerals that it's...
Well, when you say another plant, part of the gene that's inserted in a Roundup Ready gene, why it lives and grows is because it's resistant to it, and that there's a gene there that allows it to grow. However, it is proven that the seeds and the plants that grow, if genetically modified, they actually take up less minerals.
Oh, so they... So I've still got to get back to what happens with the minerals that glyphosate has acquired.
Locked up.
They've locked it up. So it's not available to anything.
That's right. And in some cases, for years.
Until nature breaks it down.
More or less,
Or less. Okay. Yeah, but the GMO-ready plants, the Roundup-ready plants, don't require as much mineral content? That's why they survive?
Well, that's basically it. Now, the video, I alluded to a little video a while back, and Dr. Albright shows a stack of carrots on the left, a stack of carrots on the right. And he asks, which of these carrots have more minerals in it? Every plant, every creature, every human being wants to live and survive. Every microbe wants to live and survive. You look at these two piles of carrots, you cannot tell the difference. You look at the two, the alfalfa I spoke about, the irrigated one, which is quite mineral deficient in comparison to the dryland alfalfa.
It looks better, but it's deficient.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So So we have a problem with leaching, when with just rains naturally washing minerals away. Farmers, I know farmers, they get 4 hay crops a year. Can you imagine? 4 hay crops a year they take off their fields. And they're shipping out, they're literally mining minerals. They're mining them out of there.
Shipping it to other places.
Every pound of chicken or beef that is sold off a farm, minerals are exported. They're coming off the farm. So the big concern is mineral deficiency. 50% of all of the sicknesses people and animals get are due to lack of minerals, and also mineral imbalances.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects our gut flora, and more people are aware of probiotics and what have you. And we know that we have millions, billions of
trillions,
different, you know, in our gut. And, you know, I was just reading from a book, Natasha Campbell, who's a neurologist and a nutritionist born in Russia. Her son has autism. She basically cured it. And she is a lady that invented the GAP diet. Now, this is not some kind of a diet to lose weight or whatever. This is to get your body back into shape with microbes that are going to work, like leaky gut syndrome and what have you, to repair these problems. So, and microbes is really what it's all about. Everybody should eat a tablespoon of sauerkraut every supper, let's say. You should have kefir. You should eat butter. Don't touch margarine, like, at all. It's one molecule from plastic, basically, margarine, regardless of what the ads say. So people have to get off their butts, and they have to start reading. But unfortunately, labeling in Canada, as far as GMOs are concerned, we don't have it.
So let's summarize, because we are going to run out of time, and we were going to talk a lot about Monsanto. Mm. We've only talked a little bit, but you've laid some of the foundation for a discussion about Monsanto. So we just need you back. So we'll do that. We'll arrange something after the show. We've got the glyphosate. It's robbing the soil and the weeds and other things that we don't want of mineral content.
Ties them up.
It ties them up, whatever
that
may mean.
Yeah.
And we'll explore that another time. It ties them up.
Mm-hmm.
The corn, say, that is Roundup Ready, doesn't require as many minerals as the other plants, and therefore it's not affected. Is that right?
Basically it. But how nutritious is that corn?
Well, I was going to ask. And have we measured that? Have we measured Monsanto corn against non-Monsanto corn for nutritional value? Do we know the difference?
Well, we know that just the genetically modifying the seed and planting it in your backyard or my backyard, that there is a substantial, like 20% plus reduction in mineral take up from just genetically modifying it.
Okay, so we know that plant doesn't have the minerals that we're at. We only eat plants.
That's right.
For their inherent vitamins that the plant has to deal with minerals.
Right.
And so we eat the plant because it's made minerals bioavailable to us.
Correct.
Now, if there aren't any minerals there or aren't sufficient minerals, the plant can look good.
Yes.
But it's not going to have the value that we want.
That's right.
Well, why hasn't Monsanto simply been stopped on a nutritional basis?
How many? It took 40 years to finally get the cigarette companies to get cigarettes basically under control, or, you know, it's a lot about money.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot about money and power. They are one of the most powerful companies in the world, and governments have been approached by them, and the control. I mean, it's only that a lot of people are waking up to it, and the younger people, of course, are right on top of this. And no matter what they say or do, the cat's out of the bag. So try to stop that. and as much as they may or try.
All right. Well, silly me. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought somebody would have, you know, a conscience or something at that mm-hmm. point. And this is Food Action with Jerry Paquette and my guest, Herman Drescher. Now, Herman, we've only got about 3 minutes. Let's sum up in a way that points to our next discussion about Monsanto and your march and what that accomplished. I want to say, first of all, I joined you in that march. What an exciting group of people there was, and what a diverse number and origins of people there. You know, some of them were farmers, some of them were not. Some of them were from Enderby, where you held the march, some were not. And the cars honking their horns, I mean, it was exciting. I don't know what it accomplished, but it's the kind of thing that grassroots gets to do and I think has to do. So I want to congratulate you and your wife, Inger, for that. That was very exciting. And you're going to do it again. That was your second go.
Right, right.
Okay, so yep. You're all pissed off at Monsanto. You've given us a small insight into it, but we need more. And what we need more of, I think, is as much fact as we can get, because there's arguments for it and there's arguments against it, and I know most people are just confused. We have local farmers here who use Roundup. I go to some of the major home plant and garden shops, and they sell Roundup, and I ask them why, and they say, well, it's only got a short half-life, and that's the final answer. And I know that's not the final answer.
No,
but
no.
I'm not sure I know what to say to the owners to say, stop selling that stuff, except not to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But I need the argument. I need mm-hmm. the facts. So will you come back and talk about this?
Sure.
And
sure.
What would you like to focus on when we...
Well,
when we...
you know, it's the glyphosate and the acceptable levels, the parts per million that are allowed. For example, 400 parts per million for animal feed in the non-grass group. Sugar in the States, I believe it is, 30 is for barley, bran, whatever, 25 for almond hulls, beet sugar, and dried pulp. So what happens is when we get glyphosate levels and that exceed these, what the government does is raise, like the USDA or you know, they allow it to be raised up again because 400
more
is the norm. In other words, more is acceptable. Yeah. And the thing is, slowly we are poisoning us and the planet.
Okay, let's end with that.
Sure.
Because those are the boys singing in the background. That means I'm being kicked out of here.
Sure.
And I just want to let everybody know from a study in Europe that everybody they tested, over 2,000 people, had glyphosate in their urine. There wasn't an exception.
Right.
So we'll pick that up next time I'm able to talk Herman to come back in. So Herman, thank you so much for coming on Food Action.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.